From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson. On today's program, India aims to build relations with Sri Lanka amid possibilities the island nation may be building Chinese ties. Frances Alonso presents Women Rising. Today she explores human trafficking in Japan. The many lives of a Chinese-American author is the subject of China Focus with Sarah Williams. People who have a twin sibling often describe the experience as both a blessing and a curse. That's in today's American Cafe with Ira Melman. It may be time to move over to the passenger seat and let your car do the driving. We'll buckle up with David Byrd's Now segment. We have news, business, sports, all coming up on today's VOA Global. And welcome to Daybreak Asia, our summary of Asian news and events today for Tuesday, February 17th. I'm Jim Stevenson. In brief, a visit by Sri Lanka's new president to India has given fresh momentum to relations with the two countries, signing a civil nuclear energy agreement. As Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, the visit is signaling a commitment by both countries to rebuild relations that were set back because of Sri Lanka's ties to China.
Sri Lankan and Indian leaders sounded upbeat after holding talks Monday in New Delhi, noting that Sri Lankan President Maithripala Sirisena had made India his first stop abroad. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi called it a moment of unprecedented opportunity.
Our destinations are interlinked. Our security and prosperity are indivisible.
President Maithripala Sirisena, who came to power after winning a surprise victory last month, spoke of fruitful results, bringing the relationship to greater heights. The most significant agreement calls for India to help Sri Lanka build its nuclear energy infrastructure. Prime Minister Modi called it a sign of trust between the two countries. They will also expand defense and security cooperation. The Sri Lankan president's decision to make India his first stop out of the country is seen as a sign of his intention to put relations back on track as he seeks to rebalance his country's foreign policy. The previous Sri Lankan government, headed by Mahinda Rajapakse, had built close ties with China, which is spending billions of dollars to build ports and other infrastructure in the island nation. South Asia strategic analyst S.D. Mooney with the Institute for Defense Studies and Analysis in New Delhi says India was worried about Beijing building strategic assets close to its southern borders.
India would like to impress upon Sri Lanka that while you go ahead with your economic cooperation with China, keep in mind the sensitivities in security terms about India's interest and concern.
The Sri Lankan government has ordered a review of a $1.5 billion project that has raised the most concern in India, a new port city to be built by Beijing in Colombo. With hopes high in India that it can wean the strategic island nation away from Chinese influence, Mr. Modi is to visit Sri Lanka next month. Analysts say the challenge for Sri Lanka will be to balance ties between India and China, whose financing it will continue to need. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
There are continuing tensions between Thailand's military junta, which seized power from the country's elected government last May, and the United States, which has called for the immediate end to martial law and a return to democratic rule. That has led to changes in an annual multinational military training exercise in the kingdom. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from the Royal Thai Navy's Utapao airfield, where troops carried out a mock mass evacuation of Japanese, American, and Thai civilians.
A devastating earthquake has struck in an Asian nation. Countries are anxious to rescue their traumatized nationals and get them out of harm's way. That is the scenario that played out at the tip of the Gulf of Siam during the Cobra Gold military exercises. The annual multinational drill, which has run for more than 30 years, this year involves some 6,700 participants and observers from 24 nations. But the 2015 edition almost did not happen. The United States took a hard look at canceling after Thailand's military carried out another coup last year. In the end, Washington decided to scale back Cobra Gold. Proponents of continuing Cobra Gold say if the U.S. military chooses to disengage from Thailand, the junta could seek closer ties with China. Steve Herman, VOA News, Utapao Naval Airfield, Taiwan.
Japan says it emerged from recession in the fourth quarter of 2014, but just barely. Gross domestic product expanded 0.6% from October to December in the third largest economy, following two quarters of contraction. But the preliminary figure released Monday means growth for the year was flat at 0%, while real wages fell. It is the slowest growth in Japan in 3 years. Meanwhile, foreign direct investment in China picked up in January, with overseas companies pumping money into the services sector. The so-called FDI jumped more than 29%. That's the biggest increase in 4 years. However, analysts say the surge coincides with the start of the Chinese New Year, February 19th. China's manufacturing sector contracted last month for the first time in more than 2 years, another sign of downward pressure in the world's second-largest economy. The government is trying to rely on domestic consumption and less on exports while introducing reforms to boost the private sector over state-run enterprises. Scott Kennedy of the Centers for Strategic and International Studies told VOA's Victor Beatty the jobless rate is pretty impressive, allowing the government room to put its reforms in place.
Unemployment is around 3 to 4%. They still have a lot of room to maneuver with interest rates, with the reserve required ratio that, in terms of the amount of, that banks hold, with the basic money supply. And there's some other levers that they're trying to use to make the economy more efficient overall. So I think we'll see relatively slow growth this year. I don't think we're at a tipping point where we're on the precipice of some crisis.
The Reuters article says the government aims to put the economy on a more sustainable footing, as you mentioned, over time, by encouraging capital away from state enterprises into more efficient private sector. If, in fact, we're seeing the privatization increasingly of the Chinese economy, will this have any ripple effect on any political reforms underway?
I don't think so. Definitely the private sector in China is much more efficient than the state-owned sector. The return on assets is probably double, if not triple, that for state-owned enterprises. And already about two-thirds of the economy in China is in private hands. And, you know, that's going to continue in that direction. I do not think that this has really any significant consequences for China's political system or the Communist Party's hold on power. Private companies in China are more efficient, they're more productive, they're more innovative, but they have learned how to adapt to survive within this political system, not outside it.
Do you see economic growth this year and perhaps 2016 at below 7%?
2015 certainly could be. They're still unwinding a significant amount of debt. This may be the year of slowest growth. I think in 2016, especially in the second half, we'll probably see more significant progress, because I think we need to remember that in addition to China going through a structural transformation, they're in the middle of a business cycle, which is at its lowest point right about now. And so things ought to be improving in 2016.
The Chinese economy grew at 7.4% in 2014, the slowest rate since 1990, and data so far this year points to slowing momentum. I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia is a weekday feature of VOA. Stop by voanews.com for these and many more stories, and subscribe to the free Daybreak Asia podcast. It's time for us to hear what you've been saying about some of the stories we've been presenting on VOA Global and on our website at voanews.com. Cricket is big in much of the world. India defeats Pakistan for its sixth straight time. Arch-rival Pakistan, of course, going down to India in the World Cup cricket match, setting off a jubilant celebration in New Delhi. Also complaints from Pakistani fans about their national team. Well, Vinod Kohli from India wrote on our website, "It's a strange article coming from a country that hates the sport." I don't know that we actually hate cricket, but it's just not as popular here in the United States as it is elsewhere. But at least we got to share in the joy or the defeat, depending on which side you're on. Another story on our website, Pakistan battles rising sectarian violence. The attack on a Shiite mosque in Peshawar that killed 20 people Friday came 2 weeks after another devastating attack on a Shiite mosque in southern Pakistan that killed 60. From VOAnews.com, Willie Webb out of Phoenix, Arizona writes, of course, it's Muslims killing Muslims. The Muslims will blame the United States somehow. That's his opinion. Alex writes, I agree that Pakistan's internal problems are the direct result of their external foreign policy. Either you have a real democracy or people like the Islamic State running the country. Well, that's another opinion. At the beginning of this year, Indonesian President Joko Widodo cut long-standing government-funded fuel subsidies. Herbert Inhaber writes, it would be useful to know what the original and final subsidies were, so many dollars per liter, etc. Also, did you just apply to gasoline or other fuels as well? Well, a good question. We will certainly be diving into that story as it continues to develop. You can write to us at voaasia@voanews.com. This is VOA Global on the Voice of America, and we enjoy hearing all of our listener comments, whether through Facebook, Twitter, Weibo, or on our website. And we'd also like to thank everybody who's written to us for a 2015 VOA calendar. If you've happened to receive your calendar already, write to us, voaasia@voanews.com. We'd love to hear if you have, in fact, received it. Beautiful scenes of the southwestern United States on it this year.
To this edition of Voice of America's Women Rising, I'm your host, Frances Alonso. Describing the women who are victims of human trafficking can be difficult. Who are these women? Where did they come from? How did they become victims? Marcela Loaiza of Colombia is a victim of human trafficking and founder of the Marcela Loaiza Foundation. She wrote a book titled Atrapada por la Mafia Yakuza, or Trapped by the Yakuza Mafia, detailing her story as a human trafficking victim taken to Japan and forced into prostitution. She tells me that she shares her painful story to put a face on human trafficking.
When I was in one of my jobs, I was a professional dancer in the nightclub. A guy, he wanna offer me international job for dancer because he wanna help me to become famous. I really need this money. And he said, how much money do you want? And I say, I need $500. Right away, give it to me. And he said, no worries, I'm going to help you. You're going to become famous pretty soon. And you're going to pay the money back. Don't worry about it. And less than a week, he buy my ticket and everything, and I was in Japan. At the first day, I remember the other person say, you need to work a lot. And I say, look, I work. Of course, I pay your money back. I pay you $500. And that person say, no, you're not going to have to pay me $500. You have to pay us $50,000. You're going to be prostitution right now. And I'm crying, and I say, why do you do this to me? Let me do something different. I work, I do whatever you want, but please, I don't want that kind of job. And she say, no, that is the job. You have it right now, and you need to pay my money back. So, and I say, what happened if I want to call the police? What happened if I want to escape? And she say, okay, you can call the police. Maybe they're going to understand. Probably they help you, and probably they return to your country. But I don't know if you're going to have a time for your daughter's funeral. So as soon as when she say that, I say, look, I do whatever you want, but please don't touch my daughter, don't touch my family. And she say, okay. And I work in prostitution for 18 months.
Did you see a bunch of other young girls, new girls that were brought in as well?
Of course, the same situation. In just one street, when it was the Kivokuro Street, 27, 30 young girls from different countries, from Colombia, from Venezuela, from Mexico, Ecuador. To be honest, more Colombian and Russia and Philippines, too.
Is it always the same, let me try to help you, is that how they work?
Yes, that is the first way they try to de-attrap the potential victim. So almost more poor countries, they don't have a job, they don't have good education, they don't know about human trafficking, and they are very potential victims for human trafficking. But most of the people I talked to them when I was in Japan, it's almost the same situation for one family member of the family sick, or they don't have a house, they buy a house, they want to get a little better life, and they thinking they never, nobody feel victim because they feel, you know, I don't have a job in my country. I don't have any choices. I mean, this is hard. This is deeply painful, but at least eventually I'm going to buy a house for my family. And that's what the people don't, when they go back to their country, they don't report the case, they don't say anything, and they feel horrible as a person, but they don't want to say anything because they feel embarrassed, they feel bad, they feel guilty, they feel, it's a horrible time, it's horrible. Most of the people don't want to escape because they are very bad, the Yakuza Mafia, and we saw how they intimidate, how they attack.
What do you want people to take away from your story?
I want the young kids, I want them to hear my story and inspire victims. If you're Marcela Loaiza, survivor, and did it, and I have a beautiful life and beautiful kids, they can do it.
That is Marcela Loaiza, founder of the Marcela Loaiza Foundation. You can read more on her organization and her book at MarcelaLoaizaFoundation.com. You can listen to this podcast and check out other podcasts of Women Rising at VOAnews.com. I'm Frances Alonzo. Thank you for joining me on Women Rising.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. Chinese-American author Anshi Men has lived several lives in one life. Born in Shanghai in 1957, she spent time in a labor camp during the Cultural Revolution. She was chosen by Mao Zedong's powerful wife, Jiang Qing, to act in a film about workers. Following Jiang's loss of stature after Mao's death in 1976, Min left China to study in the United States. She eventually wrote a novel about Jiang, Becoming Madame Mao. Min stopped by VOA Studios recently, and I asked her about her early experience as an actress.
I was a peasant working the labor farm, and a crew of talent scouts from Shanghai Film Studio came in and picked me. And I was put in the group of hundreds of people, pretty much like a Miss America competition, except that the measurement was the opposite. I had to look like proletarian, which I did. And they measured how thick the callus was on my shoulder, and they saw my hands with filled with, you know, blisters and everything. But I didn't know how to act. The only thing I know was to recite Mao quotations and Mao poems. And I was selected to portray her ideal woman. Actually, was for the film, for her to pave her way to take over China after Mao's death. So we started training and a screen test. I proved to be a lousy actress. By the way, I couldn't function. It was the only thing on my mind was, I better do what they say, or they're going to send me back to the labor camp. Uh-huh. And I already have the injured backs, and I wanted to stay. But anyway, training started like early 1976, and then September 9th, 1976, Mao died. October 8th, Madame Mao was overthrown. And 2 months later, I was denounced as Madame Mao's trash.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you ever meet her?
I did not meet her, but I was told that all the film shots they sent to Beijing was considered horrible because we'd never seen a movie. We only saw the stage telegram, like a teleplay opera. But Madame Mao considered the footage awful, had the crew went to Beijing in her personal viewing theater, which was a surprise to me because I saw black sofa. They're kind of old. But we saw two movies, and before that two movies, we were told that do not be influenced, be poisoned. We are only there to learn the technique. And the camera learned the shooting, the actors learned the performing, and two movies was Madame Mao's favorite, which she imported from America. One was called Sound of Music, and the other was Jane Eyre. And of course, we were poisoned. And later on, when I wrote about my book, Becoming Madame Mao, which is portray Mao through Madame Mao's eyes, mm-hmm. and the Madame Mao I knew, was that these two movies really reflect and was close to her life. Look, Madame Mao was 20 years younger than Mao, like a Jane Eyre. And Mao's got a mad wife, He Zizhen. And Mr. Rochester in Jane Eyre had a mad wife up in the attic. Mm-hmm. And Madame Mao took over care of Mao's children. And Maria, in Sound of Music, took over the children. So that was a side of Madame Mao. She was evil. She was responsible for the murder of millions of people. But in the meantime, there's another side of that evil. I wouldn't say inspired, but that's the fact that I was very stunned by her, what she said, the last words when she was sentenced to death. It was a public trial televised nationwide, and she says, 我是主席的狗. She shouted, 我是主席的狗, 主席让我咬谁就咬谁. I am Mao's dog. Mao asked me to bite, I bit. And that's how she it's her self-portrait, and it could not be more perfect. She's a mad woman in a way. In the end, she was with Mao, followed him 38 years, and became a backyard concubine. She turned that resentment and hatred to any woman that she prosecuted, any woman who was in her way.
Author An Chi Min. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
This is Asia Business News on VOA Global. I'm Jim Stevenson. After stumbling out of recession last quarter, Japan's economy looks set to do something rather familiar this year. That's slumber. Helped by higher exports, the country's GDP grew an annualized 2.2% in the last quarter of 2014, according to government statistics released Monday. But the recovery from 6 months of contraction was weaker than forecast. For all of 2014, the world's number three economy stagnated, neither shrinking nor expanding, as the recession, which was triggered by a sales tax hike in April, canceled out the growth that occurred at the beginning and end of the year. Wages, meanwhile, fell 0.1%. Experts expect a similar performance for the economy this year, despite the government and the Bank of Japan's Herculean efforts to end two decades of malaise. An Australian company has recalled its frozen berry products following hepatitis, an outbreak linked to poor hygiene and water supplies in a Chinese packaging plant, and that's reigniting fears about the safety of the Asian giant's food exports. According to Reuters, Australian authorities were investigating Monday after as many as 9 people were diagnosed with a disease after they ate the Paddy's Foods Limited berries, which were grown in Chile and China before being packaged at the Chinese factory. Food safety has long been an issue in China, where pollution from rapid industrialization has exacted a heavy toll on soil and water. Japanese industrial robot maker Fonuc says it will invest more than $1 billion in new factories and research facilities at home, days after one of New York's most well-known hedge funds called on it to return more cash to investors. That's a look at Asia Business News on VOA Global. This is VOA Global on the Voice of America. Jim Stevenson along with you today. And we're looking forward to the latest world news. Michael Lippin will be coming in very shortly with International Edition. And we'll be looking forward to all the latest headlines and news. A little bit earlier, we were asking you if you had received one of your calendars, if you had requested one earlier, a 2015 VOA calendar, to write to us and ask us if you had actually received it. We'd love to hear from our listeners, and certainly we'd like to make sure that all of the calendars that we have mailed out have actually arrived at their destinations as, hey, it's February now. We'd like you to be able to use your calendars for the rest of the year, featuring scenes of the beautiful southwestern United States, one on each page for every month of the year. You know what? I discovered a few still sitting in a box under a table. So, that in mind, I'd like to mail those out. If you have not requested one, or if one has not yet shown up at your doorstep, you can write to us, voaasia@voanews.com. Be sure to include your full postal mailing address in English and, if applicable, in your native language, and that might help speed up the mailing process. We'd like to send you a calendar. So that address again, voaasia@voanews.com for one of our free, did I stress, free 2015 VOA calendars. And we'll send those along to you. Latest world news coming your way next. International Edition and Michael Lippin.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. In today's show, Egypt teams up with Western-backed Libyan forces to strike Islamic State targets in Libya. Fighting around a Ukrainian government-controlled town jeopardizes a new ceasefire deal. And Denmark's leader speaks out about the weekend terror attacks in her country's capital. I'm Michael Lippin. Egypt has carried out a second round of airstrikes on Islamic State targets in eastern Libya in retaliation for the group's massacre of 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians in the country. The Islamic State revealed the massacre in a video published on the internet on Sunday. Libyan authorities said Monday Monday's Egyptian airstrikes killed dozens of militants and several civilians in the Islamic State stronghold of Darna. They said warplanes of Libya's eastern-based and western-backed government joined the Egyptian airstrikes, targeting militant weapons caches and training camps. The rival Libyan government based in the capital Tripoli, which is supported by some Islamist groups, denounced the airstrikes as a violation of Libyan sovereignty. Heather Murdoch has more from Cairo on the aftermath of the videotaped massacre.
In the video, 21 Egyptian Christians appeared to be slaughtered on a beach by Islamic State militants.
إن مصر تحتفظ لنفسها بحق الرد.
After the video was released, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi promised to hit back, saying Egypt has the right to retaliate when and how it chooses. But Ziad A. Akel, a senior researcher also at Al-Ahram Center, says the airstrikes could signal that Egypt's policy against Islamic State might be changing. In the past, he says, Egypt has supported the Libyan military mainly with training and capacity building.
I don't think that they will continue in that manner. I think that Egypt is about to rethink the pattern of its involvement within Libya. The real policy change, I think, is coming on the way.
The shift, he adds, is unlikely to mean Egyptian troops on the ground. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
A day-old ceasefire in eastern Ukraine appeared to be on the verge of collapse Monday as pro-Russian separatists and Ukrainian government forces exchanged artillery fire in the town of Debaltseve. Rebels who have surrounded Ukrainian troops in the rail hub offered them a safe exit if they lay down their arms. But Ukraine's government rejected the idea and said Debaltseve lies within its territory under the truce negotiated last week by President Petro Poroshenko with the leaders of France, Russia, and Germany. The U.S. State Department said it is gravely concerned by the deteriorating situation in and around Debaltseve. It called on Russia and the separatists that it backs to stop all attacks immediately and engage with monitors of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe to facilitate the ceasefire. Eurozone ministers have given Greece an ultimatum to request an extension for its debt bailout program despite Athens' strong objections. Eurogroup chairman Jeroen Dijsselbloem, who is also the Dutch finance minister, said after inconclusive talks in Brussels that Greece had the rest of this week to come into line. The Greek government has so far rejected that option, arguing that the conditions attached to the bailout package have plunged Greece into poverty. If Athens does decide to request an extension as demanded by the Eurozone, the Eurozone finance ministers could meet again this Friday to discuss options to ease some terms of the program for Greece. Another possibility is that Greece could be forced out of the Eurozone. Danish Prime Minister Helle Thorning-Schmidt has said there is no indication that the gunman who killed two people in attacks on a Copenhagen free speech event and the synagogue was part of a terrorist cell. Speaking Monday, she said the 22-year-old gunman who was born in Denmark is someone that was known to police for several criminal acts and gang connections. Danish authorities have not named the gunman officially, but several Danish news agencies have identified him as Omar Abdel Hamid El Hussein. The Danish intelligence chief said investigators believe the gunman was inspired by Islamic radicalism. But Ms. Thorning-Schmidt said the two shootings were not a conflict between Muslims and non-Muslims.
This is a conflict between the core values of our society and violent extremists.
Danish police have jailed two people suspected of helping the assailant in the Copenhagen shootings. The attacks have drawn condemnation across Europe, and the suspect has a similar profile to the men who carried out recent attacks in Paris that killed 17 people. Lisa Bryant reports from the French capital.
Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo traveled to Copenhagen to express her solidarity with the city and its people. She and the city's mayor, Frank Jensen, vowed to defend free speech and democracy. Danish media have identified the suspected gunman in the Copenhagen attacks as 22-year-old Omar Abdel Hamid El Hussein. Police shot him dead early Sunday outside an apartment building after he opened fire. Like the Paris shooters, El Hussein comes from a Muslim family and he has a prison record. Danish security services say he may have been inspired by the Paris attacks. The targets for the Copenhagen attacks were similar to those in Paris, where gunmen attacked a satirical magazine and a kosher supermarket. The response has also been similar. Danish police have been out in force following the attack. In Paris, more than 10,000 soldiers continue to guard sensitive places. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The European Union has agreed to give Zimbabwe around $270 million in the first direct aid to President Robert Mugabe's government since the EU bloc imposed sanctions in 2002. The aid package unveiled on Monday in Harare will fund Zimbabwean healthcare, agriculture, and good governance projects over the next 6 years. For years, the EU has funneled aid to Zimbabwe through third-party groups because of documented corruption and human rights abuses by Mugabe officials and allies. But following pressure from African nations, the EU has gradually lifted travel and financial restrictions on some Zimbabwean officials. The Nigerian army says a town in Borno State seized by Boko Haram Islamist insurgents last month has been recaptured. The army said on its Twitter feed Monday that military operations to clear terrorists from Monguno and other communities were successful. And here in the U.S., a grand jury has charged a man in connection with the shooting deaths of three Muslim university students in the eastern U.S. state of North Carolina. Local media reported that 42-year-old Craig Hicks is facing three counts of first-degree murder in the deaths of Dia Barakat, his wife Yusur Abu Salha, and her sister Razan Abu Salha. Hicks was a neighbor of the three near the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The shooting has sparked cries of religious injustice in the U.S. and abroad, but police have said they have not uncovered evidence that Hicks acted out of hatred for his neighbor's faith. Well, that's it for International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Michael Lippin.
This is Business News on VOA Global. I'm Jim Stevenson. Today is a holiday in the United States, President's Day, and that means markets are closed. Elsewhere, Robin Hayes is the new CEO of JetBlue Airways and is balancing between passengers and Wall Street. As he is taking control of the New York-based airline, Hayes faces a difficult task, that is to increase profits without destroying the culture that has made JetBlue stand out from other U.S. airlines. JetBlue, after all, was the first carrier to give passengers free live TV at each seat and is still known for its friendly employees. And for years, the airline has resisted charging for a first checked bag and also boasted the most generous legroom in the industry. But while the airline remained profitable, it did lag behind competitors, and Wall Street has demanded change. To appease investors, Hayes recently announced that JetBlue will be adding a fee this spring for the first checked suitcase, a move estimated to bring in an extra $200 million annually by 2017. The carrier also expects to add 15 more seats on most of its jets. A meeting of Eurozone finance ministers to discuss Greece's financial bailout has broken down amid signs the discussions ended in discord. Hopes for a deal at Monday's meeting took a hit after some finance ministers, including the one from Germany, raised concerns over the new Greek government's negotiating tactics and demands. The gathering broke up after Greece rejected what it says was an irrational and unacceptable demand from its euro partners at the start of the discussions in Brussels. A Greek government official who spoke only on the condition of anonymity said the proposals were a radical departure from what was previously discussed. The official did not elaborate on the details. That's a look at business news on VOA Global. This is VOA Global. I'm Jim Stevenson at the Voice of America headquarters in Washington, D.C. Imagine getting into your car and you're getting ready to go to your destination and all you do is sit back and the car drives. That sounds pretty cool. At one time, it sounded like science fiction. It's becoming reality and rapidly. David Byrd will tell us more on his Now segment. But first, we've got the tale of twins. Ira Melman and the American Cafe is next.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Joan Friedman understands why being a twin can often be a blessing and a curse at the same time. A psychotherapist who specializes in twins' issues is a twin herself and the mother of paternal twins. In this story, narrated by Faith Lapidus, Faiza Al-Masri tells us more on the challenges of being a twin.
When Joan Friedman and her identical twin sister Jane were growing up half a century ago, there were few twins around.
We were very much stars and got a lot of attention, and people always knew we were the Friedman twins. But then as we became older and you wanted to have your own identity, people really didn't know who we were. And it was a sense of sort of like being noticed but not being known.
Like many twins back then and even today, Joan and Jane dressed alike and were always together.
The first time Jane and I were separated was when we went to college, and it was an incredibly difficult adjustment. All of a sudden, you find yourself sort of as a very unprepared singleton.
Due to advancements in infertility treatments, Friedman says, the number of twins has grown.
Today, I think the latest statistics show that one out of every 33 births is a twin birth. And I think like in 1980s, it was one out of 90 births.
And she says, twins are often still treated as two halves of a whole rather than as separate individuals.
We've been around each other for our entire lives and, you know, we're trying to separate.
22-year-old Nazi Farkandeh and her twin sister Rana have always been inseparable best friends.
The funnest part is probably just always having a companion that you can count on. The most challenging part is just feeling that everything is kind of a shared experience when you want to have your own experience.
Farkandeh also says people perceive twins as the same person, while in fact they are very different.
Our styles are completely different. She's more of a, you know, girly girl. She likes to do her makeup. She likes to do her hair when she goes out. I'm more casual. I don't really wear any makeup, and I never do my hair. I'm more into, like, literature, and she's more into music. And even growing up, I was always a little bit more outgoing, and she was a shyer one.
Like most siblings, twins often disagree with one another.
It's really funny. It's that there's actually like a huge irony in disagreeing with your twin, because on one hand, you appreciate it because it's the way that you differentiate yourself from them. But on the other hand, it's just kind of more irritating because it's like somebody who's really, really, really close to you disagreeing with you. So in that sense, it kind of burns more.
Twin boys process their differences differently than twin girls, says psychotherapist Joan Friedman.
Identical twin girls have the closest relationships just because girls tend to need and find, you know, more intimacy with one another. Identical twin girls really do try to keep the competition under wraps, whereas boys will be able to express their feelings or their hostility in a more open way.
In her new book, The Same But Different, How Twins Can Live, Love, and Learn to Be Individuals, Friedman offers this advice for raising independent twins.
I have certain things that I always tell parents, which is, of course, not to dress them alike and not to give them alliterative names like, you know, Tom and Tony and Natalie and Nancy, but to give them different names. Make sure you take separate pictures of each twin. If they grow up and never see a picture of themselves by themselves, it's very difficult for them to think about them as separate.
Reinforcing different personalities and nurturing different temperaments, Joan Friedman says, is key to raising happy, close twins who have their own individual goals and paths in life. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Your invitation is out. Every day you can hear this program and join us in the cafe at voanews.com and on many podcast platforms.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here is what's happening now. Driverless cars have been in development for the past several years. Here in the United States, Google has been leading the way, but authorities in Britain have launched their first official trials of driverless cars near London's O2 Arena. The vehicles will also be tested at Milton Keynes, Coventry, and Bristol. One model being tried out is a shuttle developed by Transport Research Laboratory. Dr. Nick Reed is one of the company's researchers.
Safety is paramount in our research, and the vehicle is detecting moving objects around it. And if there are pedestrians moving into its path, it will slow down. If they continue into its path, it comes to a safe stop.
The shuttle looks somewhat like a cross between a golf cart and a subway car. It has no windows, and Reed says that passengers determine its course by punching destinations into a touchscreen.
To use the shuttle, the user would touch the screen and then select the destination, and pressing start, the vehicle would safely, quietly, and effectively move off, detecting any hazards around it, and take us to our chosen destination.
Another model being tried out is the two-person Lutz Pathfinder, a pod vehicle produced by RDM Group. It includes 19 sensors, cameras, radar, and laser technology to help it navigate. Jez Coates is one of the project's engineers.
There's a lot of technology in this vehicle. Not only is the vehicle itself advanced because it's an all-electric vehicle, it also has four-wheel steering, and it has a suspension system. So it has all the systems of your everyday road car, plus it has all the technology necessary to make it move autonomously. It's a fantastically complicated, very highly packaged, tiny vehicle.
The British government has provided $29 million to help get the projects off the ground. British Transport Minister Claire Perry says that safety is a top priority.
Right now, 93% of accidents are caused by driver error. I'm a keen cyclist. That awful feeling when you go past a car and you're not sure if they can see you. With these cameras, obviously the vehicle is better equipped, if you like, to drive more with greater safety.
British Business Secretary Vince Cable says that the project could also pay economic dividends.
You know, within a couple of years, you know, Milton Keynes is already expecting a system to be up and running. You know, these pilots themselves are actually quite advanced. I mean, here in Greenwich, the vehicle will be running through a residential area. If the technology is proven and it is safe and it meets the regulatory requirements, the potential for the British industry is very substantial indeed.
Consumer wariness about driverless cars is one of the biggest hurdles that will have to be overcome. Even some of the folks at the rollout near the O2 were skeptical that driverless cars would be something they would like.
It's amazing. I was a bit shocked. I was a bit confused. There was no one driving it.
Want to see what happens when you stand in front of it?
I don't think I could trust a computer that much for human instinct.
And, of course, there's always the prejudice to be overcome that people just like sitting behind the wheel and feeling like they're controlling their automobile. Research undertaken by Virgin last year found that slightly less than half of the respondents said they would not feel comfortable with driverless cars on the road. And, of course, there's also insurance and Britain's highway code that need to be updated to allow driverless cars. David Williams is a car insurance expert.
currently, whoever's driving the car or driving cars are responsible for the accident. But, you know, going forward, what's it going to be? Is it going to be the manufacturer of the vehicle? Is it going to be the person who programmed the software?
Some of the benefits of driverless cars include zero emissions, reduced congestion, and allowing motorists to do other things with the time that they would normally spend driving. So what about you? Would you ride in a driverless car? Do you think that they will help the environment or reduce congestion? Let us know what you think by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And you can email us your thoughts at voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
Archaeologists in southern Greece have discovered the grave of a man and a woman buried as they had died some 5,800 years ago, still tightly embracing. A senior member of the excavation team says the discovery, which was made back in 2013 and publicized just this week after DNA testing determined each skeleton's sex, is the oldest of its kind in Greece. She says the couple most likely died holding each other. It's time for sports on VOA Global. I'm Jim Stevenson. The NBA All-Star Game was held in New York on Sunday. Russell Westbrook turned out to be the big star, scoring 41 points, just one shy of the All-Star record as the Western Conference beat the East 163-158 late Sunday in the highest scoring All-Star Game ever. The Oklahoma City Speedster had a record 27 points by halftime and closed out the scoring with two free throws, falling 1 point shy of Wilt Chamberlain's 42 points. That happened all the way back in the 1962 game. Of course, Westbrook was voted the game's most valuable player at Madison Square Garden. An arbitration panel ordered Lance Armstrong and Tailwind Sports Corporation to pay $10 million in a fraud dispute with a promotions company for what it called an unparalleled pageant of international perjury, fraud, and conspiracy that covered up the use of his performance-enhancing drugs. Dallas-based SEA Promotions announced the 2-1 decision against the former cyclist when its lawyer said Monday they had asked Texas's 116th Civil District Court in Dallas to confirm the arbitration ruling that was dated February 4th. SCA paid Armstrong and Tailwind, the since-dissolved team management company, about $12 million in bonuses during Armstrong's career. That's when he won 7 Tour de France titles. Those victories were later stripped after Armstrong and his U.S. Postal Service teams were found to have used banned performance-enhancing drugs. Well, just about every major tennis tournament has its own records and titles. And, well, here's a new one for the Memphis Open. They had all the big names from Bjorn Borg to Jimmy Connors and John McEnroe, Pete Sampras, Michael Chang, Andy Roddick. They're all on the list of past champions. Now, Kai Nishikori of Japan stands alone as Memphis's first three-peat champion. Nishikori became the first man to win three straight Memphis Open titles as he beat South African Kevin Anderson 6-4, 6-4 in the final late Sunday. Nishikori improved to 13-1 at the indoor tournament. So look at sports on VOA Global. Natalie LaRose seems to be shaping up to be the first breakout artist of 2015. The Dutch diva's Jeremiah-assisted debut single, Somebody, is exploding at rhythmic radio and steadily climbing up the Billboard Hot 100. It reached a new peak of number 59 just this week. Flo Rida's protege now drops a new video. It's a cute and colorful escapade that pays tribute to its 1980s source material, that is, Whitney Houston and her iconic I Want to Dance with Somebody. Let's listen to Natalie LaRose featuring Jeremiah with Somebody.
And we ain't gotta tell nobody, we ain't just what I wanna do. I wanna rock with somebody. Yeah. I wanna take shots with somebody.
Shots.
I wanna leave with somebody.
Come on.
And we ain't gotta tell nobody. We ain't gotta tell nobody.
Nobody.
Why can't everybody know what's good? We're our only drug. Bring us everything we think we need. Just what I wanna do. I wanna rock with somebody.
Yeah.
I wanna take shots with somebody.
Shots.
I wanna leave with somebody.
Come on.
And we ain't gotta tell nobody. We ain't gotta tell nobody.
Nobody.
Yeah. In the club like what? We be in the party in the club like what? In the club like we be in your city going dumb like what? Just what I wanna do. I wanna rock with somebody.
Yeah.
I wanna take shots with somebody.
Shots.
I wanna leave with somebody.
Come on.
And we ain't gotta tell nobody. We ain't gotta tell nobody.
Natalie LaRose featuring Jeremih with Somebody. And yes, hearkening back to those days when the late Whitney Houston was rocking in the 1980s with I Wanna Dance With Somebody. Many of us remember that when it came out. Well, in her new video, the 25-year-old Natalie LaRose is rocking a variety of pastel color outfits, and she's showing off her best retro dance moves. A lot of fun to watch. She's also hugging a glow-in-the-dark teddy bear. Well, something else to check out the video for. And also Jeremih is in the video. The Don't Tell Him hitmaker, a welcome cameo as he's flirting with Natalie LaRose. Apparently a cute visual for the breezy bop, which interpolates Whitney Houston's classic anthem. It's a fresh and modern version of it. And thanks to Idolater.com for the latest news on Natalie LaRose. And we got to hear her song moving up the charts on the Billboard Hot 100, reaching a peak of number 59 this week. And who knows, she could be shaping up to be that first breakout artist of 2015. That's music on VOA Global from the Voice of America. Well, when people used to settle arguments back in the day, and I mean way back in the day, often if they couldn't come to an agreement, they would go to a duel where they each had a pistol, went back to back with each other, walked a few paces, turned and shot, and well, if somebody was killed, that's the way it ended. We don't do that much anymore, but there is still a law on the books in Idaho. The House Judiciary Rules and Administration Committee voted on Friday to consider ridding Idaho of the rule on jurisdiction for out-of-state duels. The law passed during Idaho's very first territorial legislature back in the year of 1864. Currently, the law states that Idaho has jurisdiction if a person dies in the Gem State after getting injured in a duel out-of-state. Michael Kane from the Idaho Sheriff's Association has been tasked with finding outdated laws and repeal them from the Idaho Code. He says, needless to say, this is obsolete, as he told lawmakers, although one Republican joked that some lawmakers may want to take advantage of the statute before its repeal takes effect in July. I don't know about that. The rule has been untouched for most of its tenure. It was amended back in 1986 as part of a larger change to grant jurisdiction to the entire state rather than a specific county. The bill has its roots in an 1804 duel between former Vice President Aaron Burr and former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton. Wow, that's a long time ago. Well, that brings our show to an end. We thank everybody who has helped us out. Tracy Carter is our director, Zubir Osman our engineer, Diane Gao our managing editor, and getting a remedial course in directing. And we thank you for joining us today. We hope you stop back by again tomorrow for another edition of VOA Global. I'm Jim.